Representative Cece's committee come in here, because if you start delving into the whole issue of DEQ and contaminated meth sites and how much the state appropriates for cleanup and so on and so forth, you're running afoul of the whole nine yards. But when you get into that issue, the state has not taken its responsible role in terms of cleanup in the first place. And having had some problems in my own district relevant to meth labs and cleanup, the city of Portland refuses in certain circumstances to take responsibility for cleanup. The state won't take responsibility for cleanup. There exists no research data either on the part of the state of Oregon or on a national level to tell us how we can clean these pieces of property up. So I think it's very important that when we do have a piece of property that is subject to contamination, that people who may subsequently have title to the piece of property have notice that, in fact, they're buying a piece of property that may be subject to being buried someday.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, we agree. And the Oregon Association of Realtors has introduced or has requested that other legislation be introduced to address the cleanup of meth labs. All we're saying is it would be nice if they could show that that crime had been committed before they cloud an innocent person's title forever.
Madam Chair.
Other comments, questions? Representative Mann.
Are you making that distinction? Because this is a civil proceeding with a reverse backflip on the burden of proof. That is, we get to go in and forfeit. We don't have to prove anything, la-di-da, whereas the statute, the other bills you're talking about, the government has some burden of proof.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very
Madam
much.
Madam Chair, I guess I want to ask another question. Being in real estate, I personally involved in helping clean up a lab at a motel on 82nd Avenue in Portland that, you know, our people came out and put on their rubber outfits and went in and with independent air to collect all this stuff. They bring out the chemical companies to get rid of all these chemicals. The very next day, that business is open and back in operation and re-renting that same room again. Now, I guess my question, the reason for arguing why this should be there, is that in the event that that owner of that property turns around and sells that property, I mean, you're selling something that may carry a whole lot of civil liability along with it for the future injury to other people that might occupy a room or a rental or something of that nature. So I don't know if you have any response to that, but I mean, it would be easy for you as a realtor to say, okay, fine, this property is free and clear. There's nothing here flagging it as a potential problem, but in fact, there is a problem.
I have a question on that. I'm sorry.
Representative Mannix.
How could someone else be selling the property if they've just forfeited or if it's just been seized by the government?
Oh, we're talking about notice.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
I think this is one of the reasons why I think it's a good idea for the committee to let these amendments sort of trickle down or settle in or whatever. We need to spend some time with council. Council does have a comment, however, and I'd like to spend a minute with the proposed amendment on page 4, line 13.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, the difficulty I see with the First Amendment is the following, reading from section 3, the following property will be subject to civil interim forfeiture, then going on to 7, and then reading the amendment in, all interests held by the individual involved in the prohibited conduct in any real property, including the right title interest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The problem that I think that may occur is, let's assume that A is the person who's involved in the prohibited conduct. If they simply transfer to B, even for no consideration, then you have successfully defeated the forfeiture statute. And I believe that the purposes in this bill and the relation back was to get around that. And it's the purpose of what we have, I believe, in Section 8 of the bill, the affirmative defenses. And I believe that issue did come up during the working group, and that's the reason that you have the affirmative defenses, and one of the reasons was to, in situations where you had transfers for no consideration, that you would be able to defeat those transfers.
Ms. Hefke, have you looked together with your realtors at Section 8?
Madam Chair, we have, and our attorney has looked at it as well, and he agreed that these were needed to clarify that the individual who had not committed the crime was protected. However, I might suggest if we put maybe any interest held by the individual at the time, if we made it time specific, maybe that then would address any transfer that occurred after the commission of the crime.
I appreciate that. And Representative Clark, you have a comment?
Once we're finished with that line of discussion, I do.
Yeah. Thank you. Is this a question for Ms. Hefty?
Yes. Back to Section 15. I guess I'm not sure why your attorney thinks that a notice that the real property may have been contaminated would necessarily constitute slander of title. And
not, I'm sorry. Representative Clark, Madam Chair.
Finish if I could, that tort is exactly what its description says it is, slander of title, and it's an intentional tort. And if the seizing or forfeiting agency is simply putting a notice, kind of akin to our friendly housing committee notice of fire protection, that there may be a problem there, it's kind of it's a notice, a warning. I'm not clear why that would be a slander on title.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, because that an individual who were looking to purchase property and saw on the title in black and white that the property may be contaminated, I can assure you would definitely shy away from purchasing that property in favor of another piece of property.
Well, I mean, I understand that, but that's a marketing problem. That's not a problem with slander of title. I mean, it's the fact is, if this property has been contaminated, then I would assume a competent realtor would be raising that issue anyway, lest he or she someday get sued for failure to disclose that.
Madam
so
Chair.
I don't know why,
yes.
why it's a problem to put it in the records.
Representative Clark, we're not concerned about dwellings that have been used as meth labs. We're concerned about instances where it was not proven that any crime was committed, and the title has already been clouded. There's no mechanism for getting that off, and that's what we're concerned about.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Mannix, and then Representative Minnis, and then I'm going to close the conversation, and we're going to go back to the next witness.
Can you just specify the nature of the bill that you're talking about, the alternative bill that you're talking about in terms of dealing with this question of toxic exposure being the new scarlet letter of real property law?
Yes, Representative Mannix. Madam Chair, the Oregon Association of Realtors has requested legislation very similar to that of Representative Larry Hill that would require the DEQ to draft criteria and habitability standards for former meth labs. Currently, structures can be red tagged, but there's no method for cleanup. And in the case of one individual who went through and rebuilt walls and floors and removed a foot and a half of topsoil from the property and thought he had done everything that he could possibly do to purify that property, found that there was no criteria for which to measure his efforts. Mm-hmm. And all we're asking is that criteria be drafted whereby if a person lived up to that, then he could say, I have met the burden, and the property may then be certified as habitable.
Madam Chair, as a follow-up, it seems to me that we might put something in here that requires the forfeiting agency to follow whatever procedures DEQ requires before it disposes of the property, and that might be the answer that we could work on a little bit, so that we don't end up just putting little signals on the title that I'm concerned about government taking possession of property and then passing it on to other people with, oh, by the way, there
That's
may have been toxic substances here.
That's an appropriate concern, Representative Mannix. And would a resolution along those lines
Madam
satisfy
Chair, that
your
would,
concerns?
That would address our problem.
Representative Minnis.
I was just going to mention, you keep using having committed a crime. I think when we're looking at forfeiture, actually having been convicted of the crime is not really relevant.
That's correct.
To the forfeiture of the property, because in some circumstances you may have the forfeiture but ultimately no conviction. The other thing, too, the law is relevant to toxic cleanup of real property. As I understand it, puts the onus on the real property owner for any civil liabilities, damages, and costs. And that liability may transfer, I would imagine, to a new owner. Well, anyway, it gives rise to a lot of different lawsuits. statement. Thanks a lot. I guess the committee's breaking up here.
If there are no more questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next witness is Jennifer Martin.
My amendment is number 7, and I don't think that there are any significant problems with it other than the language needs to be changed from forfeiture lien to notice of forfeiture to make it conform to the rest of the bill. And the final sentence needs to read pursuant to section 7. All this amendment does is to give the claimant a right to request a pretrial hearing on the property and where it remains pending trial. I did want to, if there aren't any questions about this particular amendment, I did want to concur with Mr. Shepard's remarks earlier about the proposed amendment by the Oregon Credit Union concerning service. The section of the bill that the Oregon Credit Union amendment refers to is Section 6. That portion of the bill is the portion which refers to the manner in which property which is not subject to an interest by another person other than the person the property seized from. So it does not apply in cases in which a credit union, for example, would have a lien of record or anyone else would have a lien of record. It applies only in those cases where the property is wholly owned and does not appear to have an interest. If it shows to have an interest of record when the property is reviewed for forfeiture, the procedure that would be followed would be in Section 7, not in Section 6. And I think that the bill, as it stands now, adequately protects the concerns of the individuals from whom property would be seized. If there aren't any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Paul Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. There were a couple of concerns that I heard raised by the subcommittee during testimony of previous witnesses, some of which relates to the Association of Oregon Counties amendments, so I just thought I would highlight to what extent those amendments address some of the concerns that were raised by the subcommittee. Our amendments dated February 18th are in your packet. And they do a couple things, one of which is to expand the language that relates to dedication of funds that are forfeited to counties to include corrections, facilities, and programs, and juvenile as well as adult corrections, facilities, and programs. If that amendment were adopted, then the dedication of local funds, at least county funds, would include basically all the major aspects of the criminal justice system. One of the concerns that I heard raised had to do with avoiding bounty hunting. Another concern that I heard raised, if I'm hearing it correctly, had to do with how do we ensure that agencies that participate in forfeitures get to share in the some of the funds that are thereby forfeited. To some extent, those are competing concerns. But I think the language of the printed bill in Section 10, and to some extent the language in the governor's proposed amendments, address those concerns about as much as we can under the current governmental system, because it provides a system of checks and balances. The dedication of funds to counties would cover the gambit within the criminal justice system and would have to flow through the county governing body. And I think by using the county governing body as a flow-through agency, to some extent we address the concern that was raised about bounties, because the law enforcement agency or the prosecuting agency, although it might have some reasonable assurance of receiving some of those funds, by no means gets any guarantees of that, because the funds are so broadly dedicated within the criminal justice system. So if there were some abuse, if there were some dependency on the part of a law enforcement agency to receive the monies, then that would be countered by virtue of the fact that it has to flow through the county governing body first. And the same thing with respect to the state. On the other hand, the concern that was raised about how do we assure that law enforcement agencies that participate in these forfeitures actually receive some of the benefits of having done it. I think that's also addressed by the fact that it doesn't go into the general fund of either the county under our amendments or to the state under the governor's proposed amendments to go into the state general fund or the county general fund without being dedicated at all to any of the activities that really resulted in the forfeiture. So I think to the extent that it can be done to accommodate both those concerns, that the printed bill along with the AOC amendments and the governor's proposed language with respect to the state achieves that balance. The second aspect of our amendments have to do with intergovernmental agreements that apply not just between counties and cities, but between a county and the state, or a county and two other counties, or any combination of those things. And those amendments say, first of all, that proceeds would be distributed equitably. The reference to that word relates back to the federal civil forfeiture statute that talks about equitable distribution. And the purpose of using that word in the context of the AOC amendments is to say that there should be some distribution that's based upon the level of activity of the different agencies that work through the forfeiture, so that the agency that does the most work gets its equitable share based upon the level of effort that was expended in accomplishing the forfeiture. And the second thing that it does is to both encourage and assure that intergovernmental agreements that are entered into before the effective date of the act would basically be grandfathered in, not just between counties and cities, but between the state counties and cities as well.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Clark.
In the absence of an intergovernmental agreement, how does this equitable distribution formula get decided?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, it doesn't say. The bill doesn't say, and neither do the amendments. And the reason why we didn't offer something that would establish a process for identifying what is or is not equitable is to encourage jurisdictions, all the jurisdictions that are involved with this sort of activity, to write it up themselves. Because the alternative to establish some kind of a process, some kind of an arbitration, binding or otherwise, would
let me ask this, what would happen? I thought you were either going to say that we want to encourage intergovernmental agreements, and so we're going to kind of be silent on this, and about the second time somebody tries to figure out what this means, they'll say maybe we should have intergovernmental agreements from now on to clarify this. Or you were going to say the court is going to figure it out. Is there any way to do it that way?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, that...
Maybe we don't want to.
I think it's possible to do it that way. But the word equitable is obviously so broad that you could drive a herd of trucks through it. And
The only reason I'm uncomfortable. I should maybe direct this to the chair. I'm uncomfortable with us passing a bill out without addressing the question, and maybe we want to address the question by being silent on it. I appreciate that. But if there's a way that we could, in the absence of a governmental agreement, put the ball in the lap of the court to decide which agency did how much work. It seems to me it could be done via affidavit, perhaps, even. Judges are plenty good at sort of setting attorney fees. I don't know why they wouldn't be good at setting what's equitable in between a couple of different law enforcement agencies. Now, I'd be looking at Mr. Bradley here wondering if my suggestion is incredibly naive, because I suspect it probably is in ways that I don't even understand, which I guess is the definition of naivete. But
Representative Clark, I think it's a good question. But to the extent, let me see if, because I'm struggling with the same issue, and we've certainly heard a lot of testimony about this issue, and I think it's one of the, really with congratulations to the working group, it's pretty remarkable that we've come down to this being a primary issue and just a couple of other issues that I think are well within our grasp. But it sounded to me from Ms. Streisinger's testimony and her recommendation that if there were not an interagency agreement, then the money would go to the general fund, that what we were doing really is promoting interagency agreements, because I think that any agency looking at participating in this kind of activity wants to look to its share of the proceeds. So that's one element that I think is going to encourage interagency agreements. I think secondly, with this number of, that's going to encourage interagency agreements when dealing with state agencies. In terms of local governments working between one another, again, I think that the dynamic that we set in place is going to, on its own, promote agreements. The possibility had occurred to me that agreements might occur which were somehow unfair or unjust. And again, my concern is not just amongst the law enforcement agencies, but somehow that would redound to the detriment of the citizenry out there whose property we're talking about forfeiting to the state. And there is a proposed amendment that council is going to talk about that establishes a sunset date and an oversight committee. The sunset date really having the purpose of putting teeth into the oversight committee, and we're going to go into that later. But I think that all we can do here is encourage these agreements to take place.
Madam Chair?
Representative Mannix.
I'd like to run a scenario by the witness. What if we change this a bit to say, okay, it's great if you have intergovernmental agreements, but let's not go so far as the governor might suggest and say, well, if you don't, state agencies, it goes into the general fund, and I don't know what the alternative would be for local governments. But let's face it, sometimes people can't agree, and Representative Clark is getting at that problem. On the other hand, we want to give people an incentive to agree. We don't want to load down the courts. What if we came out with some sort of a scenario where we said that, well, if you can't agree, you can't agree. 20% of that money then goes to the state general fund, regardless whether it's local government or state government that was involved, for law enforcement purposes. And the other 80% will be divided among the parties by the court upon application. A scenario, the idea being that everyone knows then that if they don't agree, they're going to pay a price for not having agreed. If they each think that they can convince the court they're going to get something, well, that's fine. But they're, in effect, paying a 20% commission to the general fund for having failed to agree.
And actually, Representative Mannix, and I know you have the same sort of judicial functions within your family, and I suspect there are several of us who have this. My tendency as the mother would be to say, if you don't agree, it all goes to the general fund, and thank you very much. And I think that would certainly promote and motivate intergovernmental agreements.
The problem being there may be one party who just refuses to agree, and of course the court might take that into consideration when it makes its
I would like to take that into consideration in accounting for the general fund as well, Representative Mannix. So I'm trying to keep the general fund interest in a primary position here as well. I do appreciate that might happen.
We never gave you a chance to answer.
I think we dislike your approach a little bit less than Representative Bauman's. And we probably wouldn't think either one was a great idea, but it might work.
That's if you couldn't agree.
True.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. Representative Bond.
I was just going to say, if they can't agree, maybe you should go to local government instead, lowest level possible.
Madam Chair, we'd like that, though.
You do like that, though. Okay. Local government.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think Representative Baum knew that when he made the comment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dave Fedanke.
Sounds like my daughter. I say it doesn't work that way in my house.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm David Fedanke, Associate Director of the ACLU of Oregon. Committee Council asked if I could run through the ACLU amendments by topic area, because we are suggesting a number of different amendments, and they deal with several different issues. And I'm going to try not to go over any of the ground I covered during the last hearing. If I could, I'd like to spotlight for you the amendments dealing with real property, which show up on page 3, at lines 24 through 26, And if you could look at our Hannah Gross version, which I believe is in front of you. And the other real property amendment shows up on page 4, lines 13 through 15. Our intent in proposing those two amendments is to allow for the forfeiture of real property only in situations where the property was purchased with the proceeds from prohibited conduct. We believe that this particular amendment would go a long way towards eliminating the punitive aspects of this proposal. The importance of that, I think, is clear to the committee in terms of being able to carry out these forfeitures constitutionally in an in-rem proceeding. The second policy area that our amendments deal with is the whole issue of what the government can do when property has been seized either unconstitutionally or unlawfully. We're suggesting in a series of amendments that show up on page 4, lines 24 through 27, and also on page 5, lines 6 through 8D in our Hannah Gross version, that the language in the bill which prohibits forfeiture of the property when it has been seized unconstitutionally, or prohibits the seizure of the property when it has been done unconstitutionally, that the constitutional language be changed to unlawful. The clear intent on the part of the proponents of the bill, and I believe this was laid out fairly clearly in Pete Shepard's memo to you, is to allow the government to maintain a forfeiture action even when the property has been seized in violation of another statute. The Attorney General's office concedes that they may not maintain a forfeiture action if the seizure has been carried out unconstitutionally, unless they can justify that by evidence that doesn't come from fruit of the poisonous tree. We believe that from a policy standpoint, the legislature should prohibit the government from keeping the property if the agency that seized the property did so in violation of statutes.
May I inquire on this?
Yeah.
Yes, Representative Manning.
Thank you.
My concern here is that unlawful seizure can mean a lot of things. It can mean unlawful in substance. It could also mean unlawful in terms of procedure. And that this may be a trick provision in the sense that it might prevent a lot of forfeiture on the basis that, well, you forgot to cross that T or dot that I, and even though it's not really a material error, it's unlawful. Therefore, the whole forfeiture is set aside.
Representative Mannix, Madam Chair, our intent in proposing this language would be to prohibit the seizure of property when it is seized in violation of a statute, where there are clear procedures embodied in the statute, where there is clear case law interpreting that statute, in essence, to hold public officials accountable for following and complying with the law. We believe that that principle is the same as requiring them to comply with the Constitution, and we don't see any principled reason for distinguishing between the two. There is, as this committee is well aware, significant amount of case law out there, for example, relating to the stop and frisk statute. We believe there are some bright lines out there at this point. There is case law out there, and everyone knows what that case law means, to, in essence, do an end run around that case law is going to open the door to a great deal of litigation to determine what is, in fact, a constitutional seizure in those circumstances under the state constitution, when, in fact, we know right now what is a lawful seizure under that statute, because that case law is out there.
Representative Clark, one more question, Mr.
Franke. Mr. Franke, I guess unlawful would also include the provisions of this bill, and it would not.
Certainly. That would be our intent.
And again, the ACLU position is that that evidence should not come in, whether or not there is corroborating evidence out there, whether it could, whether or not the forfeiture could be sustained anyway.
I understand the question, Representative Clark. Madam Chair, I have had extensive discussions with Mr. Shepherd of the Attorney General's office as to what the standard would mean in subsection 5 on page 5 relating to the fruit of the poisonous tree.